to
what happened to be here.
Say it. As time goes on, and our understanding of the scriptures is correct, and we believe it is correct, those remaining members of the little flock will become fewer and fewer. And in many areas of the country, the meetings will become smaller and smaller. But rather than this being a thing which we should regret or be concerned about because of the diminishing of the numbers, is something we should rejoice in, realizing that our own deliverance, as our brethren before us, is nigh, and that this present evil world is soon to pass away, and the glorious kingdom of the Lord be established in the earth, and bless all the families thereof. We do bring the love and greetings of the Seattle brethren. We didn't do that before. Sometimes forget these things. As you all know, the book of Revelation is a book written in symbol language, and it is the revelation of our Lord, Savior Jesus Christ, and it is filled with matters that God gave him to show the church, things which must shortly come to pass. But since it was written in the year AD 96 approximately, and since that time is now almost 1900 years in the past, we would have to say about the book of Revelation today that not only is it a book informing the church of things which are to come to pass, but we would say it's also a book that's informing the church about things that are happening and things which have happened. And you say, well, why would we be concerned of a book that's telling us what has happened? Well, have you ever seen an accident and then asked 4, 5, 6 people what happened? And you get 4, 5, 6 different stories. So the book of Revelation is God's viewpoint of what's happened. And that's really the only viewpoint we're concerned about. We don't really care much about what the historians think has happened or the nominal church theologians think has happened. We're not concerned that the Catholic Church thought it had a millennial reign of 1,000 years from 800 to 1800. That's of no consequence to us. What we're interested in is God says that this great bestial system, this man of sin, this harlot church, was to have sway and power for 1260 years from 539 to 1799. Then we have God's viewpoint of it, you see. And that's the only thing we're interested in. And so when we consider the 14th, 15th, and 16th chapter of the book of Revelation, we are getting God's viewpoint of things that are happening today in this, the seventh period of the church. In these seven sections that God has divided the gospel age into, this places it in the seventh section. From these chapters, we get God's viewpoint of things that have been happening and are happening since 1874. And that's what we want to know about. Now, the preceding chapters, for instance, the 13th chapter, describes this great bestial system, which was the sixth stage of the Roman Empire that had seven heads and 10 horns and so forth, which merely means that the Roman Empire as an empire also had seven stages, not necessarily the seven stages of the church, but it did have seven stages as a Roman Empire. And during the sixth stage, it was described as a scarlet beast. And the scarlet beast had power to persecute the Lord's people. And when the Lord's people were feeling these persecutions under this bestial system, upon which the woman rode in the 17th chapter, which was the church lording it over and being supported by the Christianized Roman Empire. Remember, the beast was scarlet, which is a symbol of Christ or the blood of Christ. It was during this period that the true church was persecuted by this for these 42 months or 1260 days or 300 3.5 years, which working out a day per year was 1,260 years from 539-1799. So if you were living from 539-1799, you were interested to know, is this going to go on forever? Is the true church always going to be persecuted by these who claim to be the reigning church, but really are the false church? Are we never going to be justified? Are we never going to be properly represented in the earth as being the real Christians? Are we always going to be looked down upon these who say they're Christians but are not? And they wanted to know when it was going to happen. So in certain pictures of the book of Revelation, you'll see where some cry from underneath the throne, and they say, how long, O Lord, are you going to allow this to happen before you straighten the matter out? Well, in chapters 14, 15, and 16, we come to the time when this matter is going to be made right. And those who have persecuted the faithful church of God are themselves going to receive certain punishments and the conclusion of the false system because of the things they did. So, chapter 13 concerns the beast, and chapter 13, concerns the beast with the seven heads and ten horns. But coming to chapter 14, it brings it right down to our day. And I looked, and my experience is this, in studying the book of Revelation, that when he says, I looked, or I saw, or I heard, that we have a scene change. And while this might not be true that you're going to have a dramatic scene change, at least you have a scene change. So here he had been viewing these beasts and the image of the beasts and the two-horned beasts and so forth. And now he looks and he gets the new scene. And we want to know when this scene is going to be dated at. And lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having their father's name written in their foreheads. Now, first of all, the lamb stands on Mount Zion. Now, from our other studies of the scriptures, we realize that a mountain represents a kingdom. This is symbolized language, isn't it? And Zion represents the true church. Because the temple was built on Mount Zion, wasn't it? And the temple, the church, is the temple of the living God. So when it talks about Mount Zion, it's talking about the temple condition and the kingdom condition. So, when did you have Jesus? And when did you have the church in this temple of kingdom condition? Was it not in 1878 at the resurrection of the sleeping saints? And so John was seeing things that were going to happen from 1878 onward. Now, 1878, we know, was a parallel in time to the casting off of the Jewish house by our Lord at the end of the Jewish age. And here now in Revelation 14, 15, 16, we're going to see the events that occur when this nominal system comes to the final end of their favor. And by the way, that favor wasn't because of this nominal system. Oh no, that favor wasn't because of the tares. Oh no. That favor was because of the wheat, which was in it. The tares, why were they allowed? Oh, they weren't allowed because the tares were good. They were allowed because if you happen to pull up the tares, you might disrupt God's plan for the wheat. So the tares fitted into the scheme of things, as far as God was concerned, and allowed them to remain for a certain period of time to the harvest. But in the harvest, tares would have no purpose anymore, as far as the wheat's concerned. God would have other arrangements for the wheat, and therefore we could go ahead and burn the tares. And so we see the Lamb on Mount Zion, and we see 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. Now, I think we recognize that in the year 1881, there were 144,000 crowns allotted. And I think that perhaps this is what is intended here. That in 1881, there were 144,000 in existence that had the stamp of God. In other words, this individual was stamped as being a child of God. Now, maybe we're trying to get too detailed here. Perhaps what the Revelation is trying to tell us is that in the seventh period of the church, this 144,000 will be completed. But regardless of that, this identifies these scenes with the seventh period of the church, which began in 1874. We're going to follow along quickly here because we can't stop or we won't get finished. Now let's notice they had harps, and there was a voice of a great thunder, and the voice of many waters, and voices in heaven. And all of this speaks of messages going forth at this time. Thunder would refer to a controversial message, something that everybody would hear. Now, if you go out and you talk in a normal voice, or you even shout, you're not going to be heard too much. But if you hear a thunder clap, everybody hears it, doesn't it? It's a great controversy. Nobody overlooks the fact that the thunder occurred. And these things happen in the heaven, which would indicate it was in the religious spheres or religious circles of the earth. Also notice that there were harpers. Now these harpers, we believe, were those that knew the song of Moses and the Lamb. The song of restitution. The song of the whole plan of God. The two salvations. The Abrahamic covenant. A hope for all mankind. A ransom for all to be testified in due time. And the only ones that could really sing this song with heartfelt understanding and appreciation would be the 144,000. Those of the true church. Those who slip into the great company don't have the full heartfelt appreciation. Those who are not spirit begotten may appreciate it somewhat, but they don't have all the strings. They don't have all the heart. And they just can't sing the song with real feeling and understanding. That seems to be the picture here. Now going on, we see in the sixth verse another angel preaching the everlasting gospel, which we think is a reference to restitution. And it was to be preached unto everyone that dwelled on the earth, and every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying that the hour of his judgment is come, and so forth. Now, we notice that this everlasting gospel of restitution was one of the key teachings of Brother Russell in studies in the scriptures and in the truth message. It went forth in the photodrama at the end of Brother Russell's ministry. It went forth in the first volume at the beginning of his ministry. It's woven through Tabernacle Shadows and everything that he wrote and preached. And it has been the mark of Bible students, because who can tell you about restitution except Bible students? Now, these Bible students, so-called Bible students, who claim to be Jehovah's Witnesses, they can't tell you about it because they have a diminished restitution, a limited restitution. They can tell you about their viewpoint or their corruption of the teaching, but they can't really tell you about this everlasting gospel because it wasn't everlasting. They changed it. And another thing this angel said was that the hour of his judgment is come. And Babylon is fallen. Now, from the parallels, we identify now in 1878, don't we? And the fall from favor. And that great city, which had made all the nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, that it would come to the time when she was going to drink of the wine of the wrath of God. Now, I think these references to wine are very interesting here. Now, if you noticed in the 17th chapter of Revelation, when that harlot woman sat upon the beast, representing the church married to the earthly kingdoms, fornicating in this fashion rather than being married to her true husband and to the true God, she had a cup in her hand full of fornication. Well, a cup represents a container, and what's in it was wine. And what does wine represent? Well, wine represents, we believe, teachings or doctrines in the Scripture. Now, Jesus, when he instituted the Last Supper, the what was to be the beginning of the memorials that Christians had celebrated concerning Christ's death from the day of his crucifixion. He said he wouldn't drink of the fruit of the vine anymore with them until he would drink it anew in the kingdom. Now these doctrines that they were hearing at the feet of Jesus made them very happy. And wine makes a person happy. It's pleasant. And so this is the thought behind wine and doctrine. But if you drink too much wine, and if you drink strong wine, it doesn't just make you happy and feel pleasant and so forth. It makes you stupid. It causes you to lose your powers of discretion and senses. Now, what the woman had done for the whole world, she had made them drink of the wine of a fornication. What was it? She had sold them, taught them the doctrine of the divine right of kings and the divine authority of the church, and the church was reigning, the kingdom was now, and they bought it. And she subdued, she made all the world stupid, non-discerning, with the wine of her fornication. People swallowed it down and didn't analyze it. Now she was going to receive a cup to drink. The same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, the 10th verse, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. Now here again, this associates this judgment upon the false church with Christ's second presence. And also the resurrected church, we believe, which could refer to the holy, could be referred to them in the holy angels here. The fact that it is a cup of his indignation or wrath would indicate that ideas or teachings are going to be involved in the judgment. And so if you have this woman reigning and lording it over the peoples of the world and over society because of certain ideas and teachings which she has persuaded them are true, then her judgment and the wrath of God would come because other teachings and other ideas would come forth that would cause her difficulty, cause her to lose that position, cause her to be brought down low, and notice that she's tormented. Now this would indicate not eternal torment as our deluded Christian friends that love the philosophy of hell, fire, ascent. This is no allusion to that at all. But it indicates that in the process of destruction, as symbolized by fire and brimstone, that it would be a gradual and not an instantaneous process. And therefore, it would be something that would occur in the presence of, something they could observe over a period of time, the Lamb and the holy angels. And the smoke would go up forever and ever. Now, smoke is a remembrance, isn't it? It's a symbol of what was. If you see a building burn down and the smoke's going up, that's the symbol that the building was there. It's gone now, but the smoke is a reminder. And this smoke would be the lesson, we think, of this false church and its destruction. It would be a reminder. People would think about it in the future, even though it was no longer there. And they had no rest, had they? No day nor night. These ideas have gone forth that have been destroying and bringing this false system to destruction. Now notice another time frame in the 13th verse. Right, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works to follow them. Now this again associates this with the first resurrection, 1878. And those that would die following the first resurrection would not await in the grave for the resurrection, but instantly they would be transformed in the twinkling of the eye and be with their Lord. And their works would follow. Why? Because on this side of the veil, the true church is going to be in harmony with what Jesus and the risen saints are doing on the other side of the veil. So they will continue to do the same kind of work. And Brother Russell in certain areas said, it's kingdom work. Why, certainly it's kingdom work. Here on this side of the veil, the saints are talking about what our brethren on the other side of the veil are doing in regards to establishing a kingdom in the earth. And we're telling them it's coming and it's in process of fulfillment and so forth. When we get to the other side of the veil, we just don't talk about it. We'll get involved in actually doing the type of thing that is bringing it about in the earth. Now, this time period, there is to be a harvest. Here is the Son of Man having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. This would indicate he was our reigning Lord in the time of the harvest. By divine authority, he would do these works and acts. The first thing in the harvest we know is the separation of the wheat from the tares. But this is not centering so much on that. This is centering more on the judgment of the fall system. So immediately after describing him thus, he begins to talk about another harvest. And says, thrust in the sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap. The harvest of the earth is ripe or dry. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle, and the earth was reaped. This goes with the previous verses. So here's a time when the earth was reaped. And that work of gathering the wheat was culminated. Now comes another angel out of the temple, and having also a sharp sickle. We believe this to be the sword of truth. And another angel came in the altar, which had power over fire. Fire represents judgment always. God's judgment. Because you can try a thing with fire, can't you? You can see whether it's going to burn up or it's not going to burn up. So you can determine the quality or nature of it. And another angel came, having power over fire. And fire is destructive. And this woman was to be burned with fire and so forth. And he gave a loud cry, and he said, thrust in the sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And cast these into the great winepress of the wrath of God. Now notice two features here. We're going to reap the wheat, and then we're going to thrust the vine of the earth, that is the false vine, that which came up from man-made ideas. We're going to thrust that into the winepress of the wrath or the judgment of God. So two things happen, but the winepress feature does not happen until the other feature is completed. And so we think that what is shown here is that in this 40-year ministry of Brother Russell, the wheat was separated from the tares. And then the trouble would come upon him. Now, you notice how in other passages that the Lord's people are called out of battle. Come out of her, my people, that you receive not of your, partake not of her sins and receive of her plagues. So time is given for them to come out, in which they can avoid receiving of these plagues. And it's also indicated if they don't come out within the time allotted, that they will end up in the plague period. And they will receive the same judgments as the nominal wheat would receive. And so we think this is shown here. First, the period when the wheat is reaped, and then the period of the judgment or trouble that comes upon the false church system. Now going into the 15th chapter, we see another sign. And this has to do with the wrath of God. See, these chapter divisions are just set in there for convenience of being able to reference a certain text. And they're not in the original, it was not necessarily any chapter division there. So he sees another sign, but this is also associated with the whole picture of Revelation 14, 15, and 16. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, saying, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. Notice again, the same thing as the vine of the earth being thrust into the winepress. For in there it was cast into the great winepress of the wrath of God. We're talking about the time of trouble that has come already upon the world and the nominal heavens, upon the governments associated with them. So this is a reinforcement or a repetition or more detail in regard to this judgment of the false church and God's wrath or judgment upon them. But now as he sees this sign, he also sees this. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the name, number of his name, stand on the sea of glass having the marks of God. Now this is the same picture we have back in the 14th chapter where they had the marks of God. Now what is being shown? Is this a picture up in heaven? We don't think so. We think the time frame, again, is the time frame of 1874 onward. The time of trouble began in 1914. The sea was no longer glassy and smooth in 1914. The masses, the wind and the waves roaring, the people were rising up in 1914. And the nations were angry, and we had World War I, and we had the revolutions, and socialism, and communism, and we've had a time of trouble such as never was, since there was a nation, ever since 1914. But this was a condition when the sea class, the people, were still placid, a glassy, quiet sea, like a sea with no winds blowing upon it. But in this sea, it was mingled with fire. So God's judgments were already working. They had already been made, you see. But they had not come to the point of the time of trouble yet. So God's judgments, little mingling of the fire, was in the sea. But the world, the class of people who had the harps of God, their position was above the sea. They stood above it. They walked upon the waters as Jesus walked upon the seas of Galilee. Through faith, you see, they were seeing all this picture. They were seeing the truth. They were seeing the judgments of the God working in the people. The others couldn't see it yet. They didn't have this elevated position. And they sing the song of Moses and the Lamb, a repetition from the 14th verse. And say, great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King. The margin says, nations. They recognize Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, coming to take his rightful authority and position in the earth. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy, for all nations have come, shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. Now, who can give that kind of a message? Who knows the sign of the kingdom except the Lord's true people, you see? And we have been privileged to harp and sing that song. Now, notice that the judgments are made manifest. You can have a judgment that's not made manifest. What was going to manifest God's judgments? Well, the Lord's people could tell the world that from 1878 onward, the false church is condemned. Come out of her, my people. But all that was a small group of people who had peculiar religious ideas saying something that didn't appear to be so. See, the judgments weren't made manifest so the people could see any of it yet. The judgment had been made in heaven. But this time frame, this period of 40 years had been given, during which the Lord's people could come out of her before these plagues and troubles would come. So they weren't yet manifested. But now they're going to be manifested, because now we're getting into a scene where we have seven angels with seven last plagues, which represent the time of trouble. And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of testimony in heaven was opened. And the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. Now, I always like to try to find what I think is a time marker here to fill it in for me and try to get the proper perspective. Now, the temple open in heaven would indicate to me that the saints are resurrected. We're having a reinforcing of these pictures. The church is the temple class. And so now, since they've been resurrected, the temple class is in heaven. Now, the temple isn't completely finished yet. And if you recall, in the construction of Solomon's temple, that it was dedicated before its completion by about a month. And that at its dedication, the temple was filled with the glory of the Lord, and no man could enter into it. So in the dedication of the temple, as well as the dedication of the tabernacle, there was a time when the glory of the Lord filled it, and no man could enter into it. You couldn't start the services for which it was designed, yet it was constructed and erected. And so this pictures this period of time from the resurrection of the sleeping saints in 1878, when the vehicle, the temple class, would all be there, but it wouldn't be used for the purpose of being a meeting place between God and man, a mediator between God and man, until this interim period had passed. And this interim period is what is shown here, until the temple was fully completed and all the saints were beyond the veil, would mankind be able to enter into it. So this would picture a time when the saints were resurrected, but the church wasn't complete. Now there is another time marker here, and that is the seven angels. Now in the first chapter of the book of Revelation, in the 20th verses, there's interpretation given to these seven angels. And we feel that this is an accurate interpretation. And the mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven candlesticks which thou sawest are the seven churches. And so we have had seven stages of the church, the candlesticks representing the nominal church, and, well, as the true, and the angels or messengers sent to them, the special representatives of God, one for each period of the church, with a special message for that period of the church. Now, these seven angels come out of the temple. The temple is the resurrected little flock, right? So this means that at this time, all seven of the messengers have to be beyond the veil, to my understanding of this prophecy. And so these seven plagues would come after Brother Russell's death. The sixth in 1878 were already there, but the seventh, Brother Russell, was not. Until 1916. And so you would have to put the point out of the seven last plagues after October of 1916. Now, just as these messengers didn't represent the whole church, but represented the leadership thereof and the special agents, they were not going to represent, be the only ones to pour out the plagues, but they would be the leadership here. And wouldn't this be only natural? Because these plagues would be just retribution against this system for all the troubles that it had given to the true church. Wouldn't it be only natural that those who bore the brunt of that, these seven messengers, would also be the ones who would turn around and pour out troubles the other direction? To me, it is a beautiful example of just retribution. But even if you cannot see the seven messengers here, I think you can at least see the church. And so these seven messengers are clothed in pure and white linen, and they have their breasts girded with golden girdles. Now, Jesus, who walked amongst the golden candlesticks, he also had his breasts girded with a golden girdle in the first chapter. And I hope I can find it. Yes, the 13th verse of the first chapter. And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to his foot, and a girt about the paps with a golden girdle. Now, this golden girdle, to me, seems to say that the time of servitude, represented by a girdle around the waist, sacrificial servitude, is finished. The girdle at this level of gold would represent divinity. It would indicate that they were beyond the veil. In my mind, it did so in the case of Jesus. And it represented a service afterwards, after the sacrificial service, and not the sacrificial service which we give during this present life. The girdle was raised, and it was now gold. So to me, this says that it represents the seven messengers and the church in glory. Now one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God who liveth forever and ever. Now that's real easy, isn't it? That's one of the easiest symbologies here. Because you recall in the throne scene, there were four beasts, weren't there? And those four beasts represented the four attributes of God: justice, love, and wisdom, and power. And now we're talking about the judgment of the false church who has persecuted the truth. And which feature of God's character would do this? Justice, one of the four beasts. It lays down the judgments of God, and they're going to be exercised in the pouring out of these seven last plagues. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. Now, some brethren believe that this temple is the false nominal church. But if that were the case, we don't think that the eighth verse would be there. But this, we believe, is the true church, and it will be after this time of the pouring out of the plagues that this temple will be open in heaven for the blessing of mankind, the mediatorial phase of the kingdom. Now, Brother Russell writes in an early article that this was the nominal church. But much later, around 1890 or 91, in penning to us the scriptures clearly teach, if you reread that, you'll notice that he cites Revelation 15, 6 and 8, and he applies it to the true church, the temple of the living God. Now coming down to the 16th chapter, we finally come to these seven last plagues. And before we go into the details very briefly of what they are, we're going to go into the generalized picture that these are the manifestations of God's judgments. Just as a judge in our court system will lay down a judgment and say, this man is a murderer, and we're going to execute him, or this man is a thief, and we're going to give him 7 years in jail, and he must make restitution of so many dollars. When the sentence is laid down, that's not the execution of the sentence. That's the rendering of the judgment. Then the execution of the sentence follows. And so the judgments are laid down, and the plagues are the execution of the sentence. It's the time of trouble. Now some quotes from Brother Russell on these seven last plagues. Reprint 5697, 5697, column 2, June 1, 1915. All the true disciples of Jesus will see and hear in this present time, due time, my sheep hear my voice, said the Master. If any therefore are in Babylon and do not hear the voice of the Lord now calling them out of this great apostate system, our plain inference is that they are not his true sheep. This does not mean that all will hear the same moment. Some are dull of hearing. They may not be living very near to the Lord. But so surely as they are his sheep, they will hear. And so surely as they are following in his steps, they will hear clearly and obey promptly. They will be eager to come out of Babylon before her plagues come like a deluge, as they will soon come. Now, he cites this to indicate that in 1915, sometime after World War I began, Brother Wessel thought the plagues were future. He thought that the brethren still had time to get out of the system before the plagues would come. And this is key to understanding the plagues. The seven last plagues to be visited, especially upon Christendom, do not mean a particular disease of the black plague or cholera, but the word stands for trouble. Now, Brother Gorgas gave a nice talk on the plagues recently in at the Antioch Convention. And in there, he mentioned that a plague means a death blow. A death blow. In the old days, if you got the plague, they were just about as good as dead. So these plagues represent the death blows upon the old order, Christendom. And of course, with it, the whole world of mankind. But Christendom is the primary picture here. It's the place where the Lord's people are. The word stands for trouble. The scriptures indicate what these are. Death, famine, revolution, distress, and overthrow. Now, there are many schools of thought on the plague. Some believe their message is the truth, the six volume study of Scripture. Later on in the days of Judge Rutherford, they quickly brought out the seventh volume, and that gave you the seven last plagues. Well, that had nothing to do with the seven last plagues, not one thing. The message of truth is shown in the three woes, the third woe of the three woes. The message of present truth and its effect upon Christendom is shown in the third woe. The third woe is the message of the seventh messenger. But the seven last plagues that Brother Russell shows here are stand for trouble, their death, famine, revolution, distress, overthrow. And it's associated with ideas and messages, but not necessarily from the seventh messenger and the Lord's people. These distresses will be both physical and mental. It will be a great trouble and distress to Babylon, when she realizes that her walls are fallen. She has realized for some time that they were in danger of collapse, and has been seeking to repel anything that might come near to injure her walls. Many good people have been fighting for these denominations, thinking that they represent the Lord's people, being themselves bound more or less by the institutions of the present time. But we do not think that the gospel age fully ended in September 1914, but merely the times of the Gentiles. We're going to have to pass along here. One thing we wanted to read at the end of this quote: we believe that this world, first of all, he quotes the scripture here, he hath trodden the winepress alone, and all his garments are stained with blood. This is both in the book of Revelation and also in Isaiah 63:1-6. We believe that this work has already begun in the present European war, which is growing in severity and awfulness day by day. So he was putting it into this time frame of the time of trouble beginning in 1914. Now, volume 3, page 153. The fall, plagues, destruction, etc., foretold to come upon mystic Babylon were foreshadowed in the message of the early church? No. In the great trouble and national destruction which came upon fleshly Israel. By whose hand? By the hand of the church? No. By the hand of the Roman Empire. You see, Gentile forces. And so this is with these plagues. There are other forces. And which ended with a complete overthrow of that nation in AD 70. We recognize that that was not the complete overthrow, but the beginning of the complete overthrow. Volume 3, page 165. These things written in 1890. These plagues or troubles, foreshadowed in the troubles upon the rejected Jewish house, will be fulfilled, as they will be, speaking of future fulfillments, by religious, social, and political disturbances, controversies, upheavals, reactions, revolutions, etc. Between the time when Babylon is cast off or falls from favor in 1878 and the time when the plagues or troubles come upon her is a brief interval during which the faithful of the Lord's people are all to be informed on on this subject and gathered out of Babylon. So we associate this, you see, this gathering out with this 40-year harvest period and then the time of trouble. We'll give you volume 4, page 267. Reprint 29:11. Now 29:11 was in 1901. It says, the time of trouble that is approaching, and which is figuratively represented by these plagues, especially the seven last plagues. I think that's sufficient to get the thought from Brother Russell that the plagues represent troubles. Now, what would these symbolic troubles upon Babylon be? Well, the first one was a very grievous sore. And it came particularly upon those who had the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. And we think this represents the people and the nations of Europe and the United States. And so this mark, we believe, was the socialist communist movement that began following World War I. And have been a very grievous thing. Everything the United States has done, the way of these tremendous debts incurred, faced the nation with bankruptcy, and arming itself to the teeth, has been done for what purpose? But to thwart the spread of communism. And much of the contradiction and abrogation of the constitutional rights of the people of this country, which has put the government in such disrespect at this particular time, has been done because of fear of a communist or socialist takeover of this government. So we see this grievous sore has continued, and people thinking along the lines of socialism and communism are thinking really about how I'm going to get my fair share of the earth's wealth. And this has been going on everywhere, people getting more and more of their share of the earth's wealth at the expense of those wealthy nations which had so much of it prior to 1914. Now the second angel, the Christian nations, the second angel poured his vial on the sea and it became like the blood of a dead man. Now this would represent that the sea would die. Now the sea represents the people, and so the condition of the people as it existed prior to 1914 is going to die. That's what being said here. And so we just saw that the saints prior to 1914 were standing on a sea of glass. The seven angels having the seven last plagues. It said that they were there, but they hadn't poured them out yet. From 1874 onward, you had the selection of Brother Russell, didn't you? So they haven't poured them out yet. And so the sea condition changed from the placid sea condition, and every living soul died in the sea. So the people's thinking is prior to 1914 ceased. And now they began to think completely other ideas, and the idea of the divine right of kings and the divine authority of clergy, it vanished, it died. And the sea class now began to roar and sing. Now the third one went on the rivers and fountains of blood, and they became blood. What does that mean? These fountains and rivers and so forth represent agencies of education or information. Water for the saints is truth. These were pouring out their muddy waters, the Babylonian waters. And they represent the universities and the schools and all the agencies of information and education. And these information and education was all designed to teach people and educate people along the line of the old order and its continuance. And now these universities, these ideas were going to die. And now what was going to happen in them? Why, the universities and the schools became what they called a hotbed of communism and socialism. And I don't know how your experience is, but I went to the university for a couple of years, and the statistics are all out there that people go to the university believing in God, and they leave not believing in God. And they go to the university believing in the country and believing in this and believing in that, and they leave not believing in it. And they believe in other ideas such as socialism and communism. So this is the changes that have occurred and the trouble that the old system has been plagued with because of these changes. heat. And we believe that as a result of this plague, there has been so much enlightenment in the world, so much a revealing of the dark things and bringing them out into the light, that it's burned them with fire. Now the fire represents judgment. Now, this is all symbolic. So what is being said here is the world is going to be enlightened to the point where people are going to be judged because they're going to have their sins revealed and their evil deeds revealed. And have you seen this? Mr. Nixon was burned by a bright sun. I think this is what's shown. And what, getting down to the practicalities of it, we're looking at the power of the press, we're looking at the power of television, the power of radio, and all means of communication that is so prominent in this our day. And these are not helping the church, not helping the old Christendom that existed prior to 1914. Now the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seed of the beast. If you recall, the dragon gave to the man-child his seed. And this seems to be a reference to the papacy, the Catholic system, which still has its headship in Rome. And there's a succession, an order here. As a result of the ecumenical movement within the Catholic Church, a Pandora's box was opened up, and reform began to occur within the Catholic system. Reform such as never occurred in the days of the Reformation. The days of the Reformation was constantly, there was counter-reform in the Catholic Church. It cleaned up a little bit. But here, it's poured out right at the seat, and it's going to eat and destroy from within. And so since this time, we've seen the Catholic Church falling apart from within. It's priests leaving it. Every year, there's fewer priests. Every year, there's fewer nuns. Every year, the Pope has less control. Every year, the bishops have less control. Every year, you have changes in the ritual and whatnot. And so if you went into a Catholic church today, you would see three or four long-haired young people strumming their guitars and singing what is supposed to be the Mass. Not a priest. Some people strumming their guitars, singing the Mass. You don't think things haven't happened at the seat of the beast. And the Pope says, I have anarchy in the church. Going on, the sixth poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. And the water was dried up to prepare the way of the kings of the east. We believe the kings of the east are our Lord and the saints. And the great river Euphrates is the people that supports Babylon, Christian nations. And that stroke port is being dried up. Now, if you've noticed, as a result of the debacle of Vietnam and the Watergate affair and so forth, that the polls that are taken of the support of government actions and authority by the people have been going just like this. Vietnam is the first war which we waged in which the soldiers decided whether they would go to battle or not. If their leader ordered them into a certain battle and they decided not to go, they didn't go. That's all there was to it. And so today, the ability to govern in this country is decidedly diminished, and the leaders are fearful because the great river Euphrates is drying up. I think that's about where we are today. Our time is up. The seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came out a great voice out of the temple saying, it is done. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of the talent, and then blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Now these are the seven last plagues. They represent the last trouble on the old order, which is going to destroy it and bring it to an end. I think the picture of the seventh one, which is yet future, may be beginning to come into play. And it's being put forth more and more, is that this hailstone, the weight of a talent, fell on men. Now, hail is solidified water. Water represents truth. Water represents people. In this instance, it was the weight of a talent, which in the days of the writing of the book of Revelation was the weight of a man, approximately 120 or 30 pounds. And so these could be hard truths connected with man. and individual rights, which would be so powerful that they would break down all the walls of Christendom, all the vestiges of social order, all respect for government, and so that you could no longer have armies and taxes and the things which constitute laws and so forth, the things which constitute an organized society. Because if you had a hailstone weighing 120 or 130 pounds coming down upon the earth, it would obliterate everything that you had built upon the earth. It would level it out with it. So it would indicate a further leveling of society and so forth. Anyway, in these symbols, we have the demise of the old order, for which we are thankful. And in these, then, is filled up the wrath of God, the just retribution features for all the troubles and woes that were brought upon the true church wrongfully. And the old system will pass away. And what will it leave? It will leave the earth in charge of our returning Lord and the risen saints. And they may think they have come through a really hard, bad time at this time of trouble, and they will have come through the world of mankind and learned quite a few lessons. But when they find out the quality of leadership that they're going to have in the kingdom,